We'd like to get started. We'd like to welcome you out to the RAC meeting tonight. It's been a while since we met. Oh, there we go. It's good to see everybody's faces again. It's good to see the RAC members again. Welcome. My name's Dave Black. I'm the chairman of the Southern RAC. I'm from St. George. I was put on to represent the public at large. We need to excuse Kevin tonight. In his place, we have Gary Besant. He'll be filling in and supporting me, and he'll give us the updates as when we get to that point. Also, we'd like to recognize two of our board members tonight. We have Steve Dalton and Donnie. I know that. Donnie Hunter. Welcome. It's good to see you guys again, too. After you've been part of the RAC for such a long time, everybody becomes your friends, and it's good to associate. And a lot of times we only have this opportunity to talk to each other, so it's great to see you. It looks like the first order of business is we need to accept the agenda and the minutes, and so I'll entertain a motion to do that, and then after that I'll go down and introduce the RAC members as well. So can we have a motion to
make a motion to accept the agenda?
Okay, Greg, we have a motion, second from Mac. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Okay, that's unanimous. Let's start down here on the far end. We'll introduce all the RAC members.
Brian Johnson from Enoch, Utah. I represent the non-consumptives.
Craig Lobb, representing agriculture.
Mac Morrell, Bicknell, agriculture.
Wade Heaton, I'm from Alton, representing at-large.
Lane Torgerson from Richfield. I'm a sportsman rep.
And I'm Gary Besant with the Division of Wildlife Resource. I'm the Habitat Program Manager.
Russ Aiken from Cedar City at large.
Nick Jorgensen from St. George representing non-consumptive.
Mike Worthen at large from Cedar City.
Gene Boardman at large, Hinckley.
Okay, the next agenda item is the Wildlife Board update. Wade filled in for me, but it's been a while even since we were theirs. So give it your best shot, Wade.
All right. I'm sure it won't be quite accurate, but it'll get you close. So it was the Bucks and Bulls permit numbers. Southern Region had several recommendations that were going to be separate from the division's recommendations, in addition to there was one that we had proposed that ended up getting being kind of a compromise on the Wildlife Board with the Dutton, or the I guess the mega unit, whatever it ends up being. It's kind of a compromise that where they ended on numbers. We did recommend, I believe, an additional 600 youth spike tags.
Youth any bull.
Yep, youth any bull, that's right. And I believe the board ended up compromising on that and going with 300. Everything else passed about as we asked, recommended. Something like that.
Okay, thank you. And then now we'd like to have a regional update from Gary.
All right, I talked with a lot of the managers today, finding out what the different groups were up to. Probably the biggest thing is we've had a lot of staff changes over the summer since you guys have met last. So I'd like to just introduce a few new people tonight. First would be that Lynn Chamberlain retired or quit, I don't know what you call it, but he's working for Washington County now. But Phil Tuttle, we hired him to replace him. This is Phil right here. I don't know, Phil, do you want to take a minute and introduce yourself?
Sure.
So, whoa, it's pretty loud. I'm Phil Tuttle. I grew up in Millard County in Holden. I've been working as an aquatics biologist up in the northern region, and here I am back in Cedar. Went to school in SUU and love southern Utah. Happy to be here. So look forward to working with you all. Thanks.
All right, and then also I'm pretty sure this happened since you guys probably last met. Riley Peck, our biologist up in Fillmore and in the beaver units, he moved up and took the wildlife manager position in Springville, and so Dave Smedley has replaced him as the biologist. Wave your hand, Dave. And then because Dave left our farm bill biologist position in Richfield to take that position, we hired Denton Nilsson. He's right here. He's our new farm bill biologist in Richfield. And then we also hired another new farm bill biologist in Cedar City. He's not here tonight, but his name's Stan Gurley. And then Cody Jones, our conservation officer up in Millard County, took a position in Vernal. And so we have a new conservation officer coming August 20th. We lucked out and were able to find somebody that had some experience working with the Smithfield Police Department. And so he didn't have to go through post and everything. And so we've actually been able to move quickly to get a new CO up in Millard County. And he'll be on August 20th. And then Gianni, who's sitting there, been helping with this for a lot of years, decided to move on as well. She took a position with State Parks, so we'll be looking to replace her soon.
Amen.
Yeah. And then also our landowner specialist, Jacob Selby's moving on, and so we'll be replacing him in the near future as well. So a lot of staff changes. Summer kind of blew us away as an agency. I don't think anybody saw most of that coming, but spent a lot of time doing human resource work this summer. The aquatic staff, I visited with them this afternoon. The thing they wanted me to bring to you is they have, right now at Lake Powell, they have a walleye contest going on. They've tagged a bunch of walleye. They've had about 700 people sign up so far. They've had one walleye caught so far with the tag on it. The contest goes for a year, and what they're trying to do is just educate people about the opportunity to fish for walleye in Lake Powell. And so there'll be several different concentrated efforts as the different better walleye fishing times come around. They'll make a lot of public releases and also tag some additional fish right before those times and try to make it a good opportunity to get the public educated about that opportunity at Lake Powell. And so for those of you that like to do that or know people, you can spread that word. That's going on. With the habitat section, that's what I'm over. A couple of things I'd just let you know about. One, I'd like to invite the whole RAC. We have a Utah Partners for Conservation and Development, or the Watershed Restoration Initiative. We have a summer tour planned for August 11th. We'll be looking at the Ponsagant Plateau, looking at some projects that have been planned there in conjunction with the Forest Service, Division of Wildlife Resources, and a lot of different entities. And so definitely like to invite you. If you're interested in that, get with me after the meeting, and I'll get your email address and I'll forward you the meeting time, location, and all that. And the other thing the habitat section's got going on this time of year, we definitely pay a lot of attention to fires. So we've got really just two big fires that we've paid attention to in the region so far. The one that's most recent is the Lower Ebbs fire up on the Fillmore unit. Ended up going about 5,600 acres. They went to 100% contained last night on that. So we're moving now into rehabilitation efforts with that, and we'll be working closely with the Forest Service. And then that fire did impact some wildlife management areas up there as well. So we'll have some internal stuff we're doing as well to do that. And then we're also working with the Forest Service on the Pine Valley Ranger District. They had the Pine Valley fire still going up there. It throws up some smoke once in a while, but for the most part, it's contained. And just kind of in remote wilderness area where they just kind of keeping their eye on it, about 2,200 acres, a lot of low intensity burn, but should do a lot of good in the areas where it's been burning. From Teresa's crew, the wildlife staff, had a really fun thing happen in the last couple of weeks. They'd been working on for multiple years, but they were able to work with Arizona Game and Fish, and we released 88 Gamble's quail somewhere between here and St. George. I'm not sure where. Don't know if they're disclosing where, but really exciting to have the opportunity to release Gamble's quail in the region and get them trying to supplement them and get them up and going again in the southern area there. And then the really big thing they've got going on is this is the year that we update elk unit management plans. And so there's elk unit committees that have been formed on some of those units. The first unit committee meeting was held July 27th for the Southwest Desert. And then on August 4th, this Thursday, they're calling it the Greater Plateau Complex, which is the Monroe, Fish Lake, Boulder, and Mount Dutton units. That'll be a meeting all together to discuss those plans and possibilities for managing those all together. So that's on August 4th. That'll be at the Sevier County Administration Building at 7? 6? 6. Okay. And then August 9th, right here in Beaver, we'll be having the meeting for the Beaver Unit Management Plan. That'll be at the Forest Service Office at 6? You awake, Dave? Okay. And then August 15th, the Panguitch Elk Unit Management Plan, we'll have a committee there at the Cedar City Division of Wildlife Resources Office, and that one will also be at 6, I'm going to assume, since that's what everybody else said. And then talking with the outreach staff, they've got a lot of stuff going on as well. Dedicated hunter season is in full swing with the archery hunt just a few weeks away. Working with a lot of dedicated hunters right now, taking advantage of that opportunity to utilize that labor to do a lot of good things for wildlife. They've got a bunch of birds in the day-old chick program that are growing well. They're anticipating they'll be able to release about 1,000 birds, both chucker and pheasant, throughout the region from that program. It's been a good one. Then we've got the goat watch scheduled this Saturday on Beaver Mountain. Phil, you're meeting at the gas station here.
8 o'clock
Saturday morning to go up and view the goats up on the tushers there. Then a couple of seminars they've got planned in September. They've got a waterfowl clinic to be held at Gunnison Bend Reservoir September 10th, and then upland and waterfowl seminars on September 20th and 21st in Richfield. And again, if you want more details on that, we can get you the information emailed out to you. And then the other really fun one that they had, the last item, the Youth Hunter Education Challenge. They just are the Utah team, and it's had several members from Southern Utah, just went back to Pennsylvania and competed in the international competition and placed third. And I heard, if I heard correctly, there was representatives from all 50 states and several countries. So to place third overall on that is a really neat thing for our Southern region people to be participating on that team and to go and represent our state well. So that was an exciting thing. And that's what I have for an update.
Thank you, Gary. Before we get started on the first action item, which would be number 5 on the agenda, I just want to go through the meeting order real quick. First, we'll hear the presentation from the Division of Wildlife. And then following that, we'll entertain questions from the RAC. If there's any questions from the audience, we'd entertain those at that time. And again, please keep that just to a question. And then there's a time for comments from the audience. But in order to do that, please fill out a comment card. We have some already that have been brought up. But make sure you get one of those if you want to comment. And then we'll entertain comments from the RAC, and then we'd move forward with motions and voting. So with that, we'll move forward to this next item, which is from Leslie McFarland.
Yeah. I'm not tall, Phil. Why are you guys always making fun of me? I know. I'm all good about it, though. Thank you for having me tonight. The first thing I will go over is just our fur bearer rule. This rule hasn't been touched for quite some time. So most of the changes that you can see in the red line draft that was sent to you were mostly clerical, except for the ones that I'll go over here that do make some kind of a change, so I want to point them out. The first one is under our the first changes occur in our definition section. Bait means any lure containing animal parts larger than 1 cubic inch. Before it had a description in there that said anything used in a cubby set had to be larger than 8 cubic inches, and that really doesn't make any bit of difference. So we just removed that requirement, and now bait is anything larger than 1 cubic inch. We did put the definition of a cage trap in the rule. That was never defined before, and those are just your box traps with a treadle. Foothold trap, before when you go through the rule, every time it talked about a foothold trap, it lists every specific kind of a foothold trap. And so we're just defining foothold trap means any of these. Good condition is just before under the Martin section, it defined good condition under the requirement to bring a tag, a hide in for tagging. So we just put that up into the definition section. And then we defined owner, because before in the rule, every time you'd see owner, it listed all of the things that make a person an owner of a trap. And so we just define it right up front, short and succinct. So those are those changes. Permanent tagging, a person cannot possess a green pelt or an unskinned carcass from a bobcat or a marten that doesn't have a permanent tag affixed after the second Friday in March. Right now it's the first Friday in March. We did change that last year because we lengthened the season. We are going to make a recommendation to lengthen the season when I do the bobcat recommendation, and that's the reason for this requested change to move our permanent date further into March, so that if we extend that season, it won't be a violation. On martens, it did have a requirement in there that anyone that harvests a marten had to bring in the lower jaw. We are not using the jaws for any kind of data analysis, and so we've taken that requirement out. And now they just need to bring us the pelt in good condition for permanent tagging. We do have some additions to the section on a person may not disturb or remove any trapping device except the landowner where a trap has been placed, where a landowner hasn't given permission for somebody to trap on their lands. They can go ahead and unset those traps. And then the owner of a domestic pet that has been caught in a trap may take their animal out of a trap. One addition to the plan, or to the rule, is to allow the use of protected wildlife as bait. Before, it was prohibited that you use any kind of carcass. You can place a trap, the addition is that traps may be placed near the carcass of protected wildlife, provided the carcass has not been moved or relocated for the purposes of trapping, and that a trap is not located within 30 feet of that carcass. And the reason for that is to protect raptors and things that might come down and feed on that carcass. We don't want to get those into the trap, but you can use roadkill as long as you don't move it to use it for trapping. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Do we have any questions from the RAC?
Yes.
Mike?
Yeah, Leslie, I have one question on your, it says a person may not disturb or remove any trapping device except, and the second part, the owner of a domestic pet that has been caught. Is he authorized to remove that trap or just remove his pet from the trap?
Well, we have some situations where if somebody is not familiar with a trapping device, they may have to take that trap with the animal in it in order to get their animal out of the trap. And so, yeah, we would allow them to remove the trap, but we hope that they would bring it back.
Well, that was my question. If they're And I know some people will run on them and catch their pet and just take the trap, let their dog out or whatever, take the trap and either call the division or just keep it. And I didn't know whether that...
We want them to either leave the trap right where it is and call the division and tell the division they had an incident, or if they have to take their pet, like I know some people are not strong enough to open the jaws on some of those traps, so if they take it, I hope that they would turn it into the division.
I'm wondering if there's any way to maybe make that a little more clear for pet owners.
We can work on the wording there.
Any other questions? Do we have any questions in the audience? I don't believe we have any comment cards on this agenda item. So do we have any comments from the RAC? Looks like we're ready to entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion that we accept Rule R657-11, Fur Bear Rule Amendments, as presented.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion from Lane, second from Rusty. Any discussion? All those in favor? Looks unanimous. Okay. Let's move on to the next agenda item, which will be number 6, the Bobcat Management Plan. That'll be Leslie as well.
Okay. Just a little bit of background on the Bobcat Management Plan. This plan is not required by rule or law. It's a plan that was put in place by the division in order to protect bobcats and just set some guidelines and things for trapping and how we set seasons. The plan was approved in 2007 and it's set to expire the end of this year. It was prepared by the Bobcat Working Group, which included representatives from the division, the Utah Trappers Association, the Utah Houndsmen Association. It had a RAC member present. It had some academia members that were present, and some non-consumptive representatives. Rather than put an expiration date on this plan that's not required by law or rule, we have put into it that we'll review it internally every 10 years. This current review is an internal review, but we did consult with the Trappers Association and Houndsmen Association on the changes that we wanted to make. So the purpose of the Bobcat Management Plan is to direct the management of bobcats to assure the future of the species through protection, propagation, and management. While considering bobcat distribution and the intrinsic scientific and educational and recreational values for the citizens of Utah. Our goal of the plan is to maintain a healthy bobcat population within existing suitable habitat and provide quality recreational opportunities for bobcat harvest while considering the social aspects of bobcat harvest. Our population objective is to maintain the current statewide distribution with a reasonable proportion of older age animals. All of our bobcat harvest, everyone that's harvested, we require the hunter or trapper to turn in the lower jaw, and then we do age portions of our a random sample of our bobcat population throughout the state to get age structure and the metrics that we use for the plan. So the performance targets that are in the plan currently, there were 4. We removed the 4th one, and let me go through these and I'll explain why we removed the 4th one. So the first variable is proportion of kittens and yearlings in the harvest. And the way that these values were determined, we took historical data and we figured out the mean range for all of the historical data. And so where we want our when our populations have been doing well, and so where we want our mean to be, or where we want our range to be, or the proportion in our harvest to be, is this range. So the proportion of kittens and yearling in the harvest that we want to see is about between 42 to 50%, 56% of our harvest. When you have more young in your harvest, that's an indicator of population growth. We want our adult survival that we figure the adult survival based off of all of our tooth data that we collect, and that's put through a model. We want that to be between 65 and 72%. And then the percent of the females in our harvest, again, if you harvest too many females, you're affecting the population. And so we like that to be between 41 and 45%. The fourth metric that was in this was set days per bobcat. The reason that we took this out is it's not a biological factor at all that determines bobcat population. It's based on the experience of the person that you're surveying, and it really or it's dependent on winter conditions and all of these other factors. So we removed set days per bobcat as a variable for determining permits. So our baseline strategy for bobcat harvest will, so those three factors that I just went over with you, if two or more of those variables are within or outside the historical range in a positive direction for population growth, then we will maintain baseline. And our baseline will be 6 permits per individual. Our season will run the third Wednesday in November to March 1st. That is an extension on the season, and that will be our baseline is to March 1st. And we will not have a cap on the number of permits if everything's going fine with our population. If two or more of those variables are outside of the historical range in a negative direction for population growth, then we would recommend a decrease in the permit numbers by 1 to 2 tags. And we would keep doing that every year that we continue to see that decrease. If it stays the same, then we would keep the recommendation the same as the previous year. On our season length, if two or more of those variables are outside in a negative direction for population growth, then we would also recommend a decrease in the season length, and the recommendation would come on the front end of the season, not on the back end of the season. And again, if the next year the numbers were the same or similar, we would keep that recommendation the same the next year. If it continued to decline, then we would recommend a further decrease in the season length and permit numbers. If all three of those variables are outside of the range in a negative direction for population growth, then we would recommend a permit cap. The permit cap we would recommend would be 80% of the number of permits that were sold the previous year. It would be on a first come, first serve basis, and it would be implemented in addition to the decreased permits and decreased season length. After a cap has been implemented, one of the things that we ran into over the past several years, we did have a cap on bobcats. Then things turned around and they went in a positive direction. Rather than incrementally increasing those permits and the season length back to baseline, we jumped all the way back to baseline, and there were some serious concerns that we might be hurting bobcat populations. So we've added in a little stopgap thing here, and that is that we can begin to increase the season length and the number of permits back toward baseline by 1 to 2 weeks or 1 to 2 permits per year if the performance targets are moving back in a positive direction until we reach baseline again, and then that would be our recommendation. There were some outreach and education parts of the plan. I won't go through all of those because they are available to you in the plan. But I do think it's important to mention that we do want to increase awareness and appreciation of the general public for the role of bobcats in our Utah ecosystems. And we've got some measures in here to try and work on this, like providing educational opportunities on the role and use of trapping and hounds in our management systems, developing educational programs on predator-prey interactions. Our second objective is to maintain quality hunting and trapping opportunities for bobcat. We work with the Trappers Association and Houndsmen's Association to promote ethical and legal hunting and trapping practices. We work through our Fur Harvester Education Program. We are trying to work right now with our Trappers Association to try and increase our fur harvester education teachers. They have a shortage right now. So if anyone wants to teach fur harvesting education, it's really fun. And then we do have some other measures in there as well. And I won't go through all of those. There are a lot. And then our last objective in our outreach and education section is to reduce conflicts between those involved in bobcat harvest, trappers and houndsmen, and other recreationists. So we do promote the setting of traps and snares away from popular hiking and recreation sites. We don't want them paralleling heavily used trails or established hiking trails. And we do encourage houndsmen and trappers to avoid pursuing or trapping bobcats in highly urbanized areas to avoid conflicts and capture of domestic pets. And we recommend that trappers avoid using lethal sets when trapping in areas that may be occupied by domestic pets. And then there are some things in here about recreationists respecting trappers and traps and snares and not removing those. And our last part of the plan is our research section, and we have identified future research needs for bobcats, including population estimation, improval techniques, survival estimators, looking at our population connectivities, and identification of source and sinks. Thanks.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the RAC? Okay, Mark?
When you have those three performance targets is low, you said permits are coming on the first-come, first-served basis. Is there a limit to the permits?
Like yes. Yeah, so like this last year, I think we sold 9,000 permits. So if we had to put a cap on next year, we would offer 80% of the 9,000 that we sold this year.
Yeah, but what about per individual? Still six?
No, and so that it's implemented in addition to decreasing the season length and the number of tags per person.
Okay. Anybody else? Gene?
Are there any trends of more people wanting to trap or use hounds on bobcats?
So I would say that, yeah, we do see increasing trends. Usually, though, it cycles with the price per pelt. When the price per pelt on bobcat goes up, we do see more people buying tags. When we first removed the cap, we sold 13,000, almost 14,000 bobcat tags, which is a record for us. We've never sold that many before. So, and I would actually refer to the Trappers Association. They would have a better idea on how many people they see recruiting into the industry.
If the bobcat prices go up and you sell 13,000 tags, then the population goes down. The cut would be from 13,000 instead of from 9,000, right?
Yeah, So if things were not, that you would kind of catch it in your trend, actually, because you would see in your harvest. So if we, so when we sold 13,000, that's not what was harvested. We didn't harvest really any more than we historically had harvested. Previous years, even though we sold more, part of it has to do with experience of the people coming in, and then part of it has to do with winter conditions and things like that. But what you would do is you would monitor what you saw in your harvest, and if it was in a negative way, like if we over-harvested in 1 year, certainly that would come out, and our recommendations would be for a shorter season length and a shorter, fewer tags per person.
Your personal estimate of what bobcats are going to do. Is this situation going to stay pretty steady with what you're doing now, that you won't have to put on any restrictions?
No, what bobcats tend to do is they cycle with rabbit populations, and there is a clear, there's clear research that indicates that. Right now we have very high rabbit populations, and so we're in a really high bobcat population scenario. Usually 2 to 3 years after you see rabbit populations decline, then you will catch that in your bobcat harvest and bobcat numbers.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any? Oh, Wade, go ahead.
How do we determine the adult survival rate?
You're going to get me on these models again. We do take the ages, and our biometrician, I wish she was here because she's fantastic with it, but we do put the ages in, and you, it's kind of like we do with bears in that you reconstruct what you have, and you can build it back to see what you had to have to get there.
Okay. Any questions from the audience? We do have some comment cards. We'll go to those next. It looks like we have two cards. The first one is Kent, and then Lee Tracy. And when you get to the mic, just please state your full name so they have it on record.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers Association. We support the Bobcat Management Plan as put forth by the division.
Okay, thank you.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. Per our predator advisor, he knows a whole lot more about this than I did, and I had quite a long talk with him about what was going on. He reviewed the plan and approved it, and based on his approval, United Wildlife Cooperative also supports the plan as presented.
Okay. Thank you, Lee. So that's all the comment cards on this item. Do we have any comments from the RAC? Okay. I'd entertain a motion. Rusty's working on one, I can tell.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the Bobcat Management Plan as presented.
Thank you. Do we have a second? Okay. We have a second. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor? Looks unanimous. Okay. Let's go to the next agenda item. Moving right along, which is number 7, and that will be Leslie as well.
This is my RAC meeting, so you're stuck with me. Okay, so now I can actually make our recommendations now that we've approved the fur bearer rule and the bobcat plan. So this past year, there were 9,447 bobcat tags that were sold, and 2,338 bobcats were harvested. I don't know if you can see this very well. Does this have a pointer thing on it? Or am I just going to move slides? Ah, it's green. So this line right here is the number of permits that were sold, and then this is our historical bobcat harvest here. So you can see that we did sell a few more permits here and here, but harvest really has never exceeded historical levels. So that's really a good trend that we watch. Total trap harvest was 1,683. Our hunter harvest, which is using hounds and that type of thing, was 140. And this past year, there were 2,338 trappers that participated versus 2,578 last year. So it was down just a little bit. So one of the things that we do look at, like I said earlier, one of our variables is to look at the proportion of our young in the harvest. And so the black line are our males, and the lighter gray line are our females. This right here is the age in years, and then this is the proportion in harvest. So 25% of our harvest this past year was yearling males. And then about between 15 and 10% were female, yearling females. So that's a really good indication that the population is doing really well. We see a lot of young males in the harvest. So again, from our bobcat plan, our variables that we look at are our percent young in the harvest. We want it to be between 42 and 56. Our percent of our adult survival, we want it to be between 65 and 72. And our females in the harvest, we want it to be not greater than 45%. We want it to be between 41 and 45. So our data from this past year, so this year's 2014, 2015, this is our current year. Our percent juveniles in our harvest are at 62, so that is above our target of 42 to 56, so that's in a positive direction. Our percent survival is at 73%, which is also above our target in a positive direction. And our percent female is right within our target at 44%. So our current, and then the guidance from the plan again is when everything's in line, is to maintain our baseline of 6 tags per individual. The season would run from the third Wednesday in November to March 1st with no cap on the number of permits sold. So that is our recommendation, with the season running from November 16th to March 1st, and then again no cap with 6 tags per individual. Our other fur bearer season dates, I just need to run those past you. Our beaver and mink season, we recommend from September 24th to April 5th. Our badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel, we're also requesting an increase in the season length on those, so that we don't have, where we're increasing bobcat and not the other ones, it would create a problem for our law enforcement and capture of non-target species. So we're asking to make them all in line, and that our trapping season would end March 1st. Same with Martin, September 24th to March 1st. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions from the right? Any questions from the public? And looks like we have, Lee. Please state your name, Lee.
Lee Tracy. I'm not familiar with any of this, the trapping and those kinds of things, and predators. I don't participate much in any of that, but and this may be a foolish question in your minds, but I remember, was it last year or the year before, when they were talking about changing the time between checking your trap and that sort of thing. Has that impacted the harvest at all, or anything? Because once an animal is caught, of course, it can't catch another one. But has that had any effect when they have to check their traps a little earlier or more often?
We haven't made a change to that. There were some requests to change that to lengthen the trap check time, but we have not made any changes to that at all. So on a lethal set, you have to check it every 48 hours, and on a non-lethal set, every 96 hours. And that has not been changed, and we aren't recommending that.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have a question, Brian?
I said it wrong. Sorry. There's so much going through my mind. I can't.
Okay. We do have two comment cards on this item as well. We have Kent and Lee again. Kent, you can go first.
Mr. Chair, Rack. Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers Association. We support the recommendations as set forth by the division.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. We also support the plan as presented, or the proposal as presented.
Thank you. Okay, do we have any comments from the RAC? Brian?
Do we want to talk about changing that, checking your traps? I'm just wondering if anybody brought that up to you guys or not. It's always something public health people always talk to me about, but I think we're good if you guys are good.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't had any comments on it. Okay, I'm ready to entertain a motion. Mike?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations as presented.
Okay, we have a second. Brian, second. Any discussion? All those in favor? Okay, unanimous. Let's move on to number 8, cougar recommendations and rule amendments.
Okay, moving right along. So, cougar historical hunter harvest. Our cougar harvest in Utah has been managed under limited entry hunting since 1999. In the mid-90s, we had a dramatic increase in the number of permits that were offered. And just to point out the table here that you're looking at, this is total harvest right here. So this is the total harvest. The green line is our total males so it's broken out by sex below. So the green line is total males, and then the orangish line are total females, and then that combined gives you your total harvest. And then you've got year on the bottom. So you can see in the mid-90s, we had a lot of permits that were given out. In about 1997, we went to a harvest objective strategy, and a record 1,497 permits were sold that year. Since 2000, we average about 321 limited entry permits and an average about 254 quota. This past season, we offered 495 permits. Limited entry or split permits, and or 495 permits total. 246 of those were limited entry or split, and 249 of those were quota. Total harvest last year was 371, with 45% of the permits being filled during the limited entry season, and 68% of the permits filled during the harvest objective seasons. Total harvest, including Wildlife Services take, nuisance, cougars, including roadkill, was 394. That's up from the previous year of 372 in 2015. So the one thing that we track per our cougar management plan is the number of females or the percent of females that we take in our harvest. And that includes yearling females, so it's all females. And so this graph right here, the light gray, so this is our total harvest for the year. The light gray represents the males, and then the darker gray are the number of females. And then the dotted line there is the 40% threshold that we don't want to go over on our female harvest if we're trying to manage for cougars. You can see statewide, including all of our harvest objective units and our predator management units, since about 2008, we are maintaining below that 40% female threshold. So that's all of our units combined. This year, our total female in our harvest was at 30%. The other metric that we look at in our cougar management plan are the number of animals that are either 5 years of age or older in our harvest. And the goal in the plan is to have that be between 15 to 20% of our harvest to be 5 years or older. This past year, 40% of our harvest, the animals were 5 years or older. So that indicates that we've got a pretty good cougar population. Our livestock depredation, so what we track are the number of incidents that are reported to Wildlife Services, along with the number of cougar removed. And this is off. Wildlife Services just updated me yesterday in a meeting. The number of incidents this year were at 60 compared to 34 last year, so we almost doubled the number of livestock depredation incidents. Total take by Wildlife Services this year was 24. So I'll just go through each of the regional recommendations, and I will only touch on the highlights or any changes. Most of our regions are sticking with the same thing that they had last year, with a few small changes here or there based on harvest data or based on deer population responses. We also are increasing some of our units where we had more livestock depredation to try and address some of those issues. So in our Northern region, if you look here at this table, the left column is the name of the unit. The second column over indicates whether or not that unit is under predator management and what it's under predator management for. So either deer or bighorn sheep. If you look at East Canyon Davis, that one's under for a different reason. That one, we get a lot of cougars that come into Davis County and that type of thing. And so that region likes to maintain heavier harvest to keep nuisance issues down. The next column over are the permits or quota that were offered last year. And then the next column over are the three-year averages of the percent female for each of those units, and then the percent of those animals that were 5 years of age or older. And then the next column over are what the region is recommending. If it's green, it's an increase. If it's blue, it's a decrease from last year. And then no recommended changes to strategies. So for the northern region, I'll just hit it really quick. They are increasing the Box Elder Desert, the Cache by 2, the Chalk Creek Camas by 2, East Canyon by 2, and then they're decreasing on the Morgan South Ridge by 2 because their percent female is over 40% and it's not under predator management. And then same with the Ogden, their percent female is too high, so they decreased by 1. On the northeastern region, they are recommending no changes to anything except for on the Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek North. They are increasing by 2. The percent females the take was only 5%. And over half of that harvest were 5 years of age or older, so they have room to increase there. On the central region, they're increasing on most, so some of the Manti unit went in for predator management for deer because they're not seeing increases in that deer population, and so they are recommending increases in some of those units. As well as on the Wasatch Mountains and the West Desert units, they're recommending increases in all of those. Our southern region units, the beaver, they're recommending a decrease of 1. And on the Fillmore Pavant, an increase of 1. On the Pine Valley North, an increase of 2. The Pine Valley South, an increase of 1. The Plateau Fish Lake, an increase of 1. The Southwest Desert, an increase of 2. And on the Zion, a decrease of 2. And then our southeastern region, they are recommending an increase on the Central Mountains, Northeast Manti, the Central Mountains, Southeast Manti, and on the 9 Mile North. On the San Juan unit, they are recommending splitting that unit into 2 and making a bighorn sheep unit to address some depredation problems with bighorn sheep. And the bighorn sheep portion, they are recommending that go to the unlimited predator management strategy. So this year, we are recommending 223 limited entry or split permits. That's a decrease of about 7. And then we are recommending an increase of harvest objective quota totals by about 12. A lot of it's just because you're moving here and there from one unit to the other. So total, we're not increasing dramatically. We're staying within what we've had in the past. We are recommending a boundary change to the Box Elder Pilot Mountain unit. This is to make it consistent with the elk and bighorn sheep unit. The boundary goes over into the state of Nevada, who we have an MOU with, to allow hunting on their side. If somebody has a cougar permit and they harvest it on the Nevada side, they have to obey all of Nevada's rules and laws with that take. They can also hunt on the Utah side when they have a cougar permit as well. The boundary change out of the southeastern region, again, is to split the San Juan unit into the San Juan Desert, which will be the bighorn sheep portion, and then the San Juan Mountains, which is pretty much all of the rest of the entire unit where the deer and elk are located. Our cougar season dates that we're recommending, our limited entry season, we're recommending run from November 9th to May 31st. Our split limited entry portion would go November 9th through February 24th. The harvest objective season, we're recommending March 2nd, so the transition portion of the split unit, March 2nd to May 31st. Our harvest objective season statewide, we're recommending November 9th through November 4th. Any of the limited quota units would be year-round from November 9th to November 8th of 2017, and our pursuit season we're recommending November 9th to May 31st. So in summary, all the recommendations have been made in accordance with our cougar management plan. All females were considered in the harvest. Our age performance target was an extra measure on population. And a lot of the increases that you see on certain units should also help address livestock depredation, in addition to some deer population concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Nick?
Yeah, Leslie, you may have mentioned this, and I couldn't hear it, but
What do you estimate the total population of cougars in Utah to be, and what percentage of that would be male versus female?
We do not have a population estimate for cougars in the state. In order to do that, we'd have to be able to do things like fly them and all of that. So what we have substituted that with are the biological measures that we get from our hunting season. Okay. So we look at age and female structure in our harvest, and that's how we kind of measure what we're doing.
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Craig, is deprivation or the conflict with wild livestock, is that numbers up or down, or where's that going?
So it was up a little bit this year. It was from 34 incidents that were reported last year to 61 this year.
That's not a little bit.
It's a little bit. And what we paid this year. So we paid a total of $148,000 this year for both cougar and bear depredation on livestock. This year we paid $68,550 on cougar depredation. Last year it was $44,000. So we have seen an increase in livestock depredation, and so that's part of the reason that we wanted to increase on some of these areas to try and reduce that.
What's an incident?
An incident is any time a sheep, a cow, or a calf are killed, or a goat. And in one case down here, it was some turkeys and some cats. Yeah.
Any other questions? Mike?
Leslie, and I don't know how long you've been doing this, working with Wildlife Services and identifying those livestock depredation areas, and does the division issue more permits in those areas or just suggest people hunt in those areas, and how successful has that been?
We can do a couple of things. Right now what we're trying to do is increase for the entire unit. But what happens is if we have an incident reported, Wildlife Services is contacted and they can be authorized. If that isn't working, our regional offices can also issue a depredation permit and we can send a hunter out. Or we can use hunters that haven't harvested. If it's during a current hunting season, we can pull some of the hunters that haven't harvested and get them in the area to try and remove the animal. Those are some of the ways that we directly try to tackle depredation issues, but just issuing more permits doesn't always get to the root of the problem. So anytime we have a specific issue, we try and go after that specific animal.
Do you have records or information where you've got a perpetual problem, maybe year after year, an old tom, anytime sheep or cows move in there, he starts killing them and haven't been successful? Do you have situations like that where you do try and target a specific
area? Yeah, so in our cougar rule, actually, we have, and actually I brought this around when I did the plan, we changed some of the law to allow anytime a sheep owner or a livestock owner goes into a place where they demonstrate a chronic problem with cougars every single year, no matter if they turn out or not, they will have a problem. We can issue them a permit and they can go in either before they put their livestock in or they can work on it while they've got their livestock in there. That permit is regularly used by a sheep person up in the northern region.
Okay. Wade.
Leslie, so on the livestock incidents, looks like there were 24 more this year than last year, but we only killed 4 or 5 more of those. Why the reason and the difference? Is it just difficult to target them, or is it a Wildlife Services just not enough manpower?
That was the thing. There was a little bit of an error on that livestock table, because when I met with them at the wool growers meeting yesterday, they actually gave me 12 more that they removed. So they removed 24. Last year they only removed 8. So there's quite a bit higher harvest on their part this past year. Part of it depends on when they're contacted by the livestock owner and how long the carcass has been there, and whether or not they can try and attempt to remove the animal.
Sure. What's the policy? Are we trying to get rid of everyone that causes the incident?
It depends. In some parts, especially on the Wasatch, where we have multiple bears coming into an area, they will sit and trap in that area until they can remove everything that comes in. So it just depends on the type of incident.
Craig? My question now deals with if there's more livestock instances, and is our deer population suffering because of there's obviously more cats out there if there's more instances of conflict.
So that's part of the reason why when we did the Cougar Plan, we started considering our deer population objectives as part of whether or not we put a unit under predator management, and then whether or not we put it under predator management determines whether or not we increase permits. So if you go here, say on the Box Elder Desert, that deer population is, and the bighorn sheep population there, put that in predator management. So we increase permits to try and get at least 40% of our harvest being females. And so, yeah, we do look at our deer population when we're considering these.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Brian.
I get that I don't have all the answers, but I say that now instead of saying that I'm dumb. That's what Sam taught me. But why are we lowering the numbers of permits on the Zion?
I will let the region address that.
You've been really quiet.
I'll let Dustin, but the other thing you have to look at when you look at the Zion, it's not under predator management, and your female harvest is at 41%. So that we want to keep it below 40 on non-predator management units. But Dustin can.
Now, she alluded to it already, that we're over 40% on female harvest and we're under our age objective there. And then all of our big game populations are over objective on that unit.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the audience? Okay. Remember, state your name, John.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. I was just wondering why there is no numbers for cougars in the state. Isn't there modeling that's done? I remember back in the 90s when there was such a large number in the population, they had modeled numbers that they were using then. And I'm just wondering why there isn't some kind of a figure, because there is on practically everything else. And then the question, why is there a decrease in the beaver unit?
Okay, so first on why, so we do have modeled numbers on cougar populations. It's probably between 1,900 to 4,000. That's as close as I can get you with a model. And the reason that we don't have more tight numbers is because we can't survey cougars like we can big game animals. We can't get flights out there and count a percentage of the population to then put that into a model and say this is your sightability index and give you some level of confidence. Anytime we do that, our confidence intervals are like this. And so we can have anywhere between 1,900 to 4,000 cougars in the state, and that's about as I know what you're talking about in the 1990s. It's in the plan. It was mentioned in the plan, but we don't have any tighter number than that.
Are there any units where there's ground truthing that's done
so that you can lease.
So the closest that we could do that on, and that's one of the things we're trying to look at with the research project, is to get some callers maybe throughout the state so that we can kind of ground truth our numbers. But it's a very expensive, time-consuming project to go in and try and collar that many cougars across the state. The closest we can get you would be on our two units where we've had long-term cougar population studies, and that'd be on the Oakers and the Monroe, and they kind of can tell us that our estimates that we use in our cougar plan for age, class, and sex are pretty similar to what you see statewide. So that's, I mean, that's as close as I can get you.
Is there any private research or university research that's being done
anywhere? To do what? That's as close as any state can get you, because there's no way to go. I mean, we're working on it. We've done research on them forever. But that's as close as we can get you to an actual population estimate. That's why we use age data and sex in our harvest, because that tells us what the population is doing in response to removal by hunters.
Thank you. Okay. We do have some comment cards.
The beaver.
Oh.
Sorry.
So the beaver was decreased. Basically, we're just following the management plan, and the percent of female, or percent under 5 years old, is below where we want that 15 or 18 to 20%. It was at 12%. So the age is a little younger.
Okay. We do have comment cards from the audience. The first one is Darren West, and then Lee Tracy. And then we have two letters that we'd like to read in the minutes as well.
Mr. Chairman, RAC, gentlemen. I'm Darren West with the Mule Deer Foundation. I'm the conservation coordinator for Utah. I'm here responding to several emails and phone calls I've received from sportsmen in the Wayne and Garfield County areas, signaling a large increase in sightings of cougars this year over last, as well as with what we've heard tonight with depredation numbers and highway mortality also on the rise, as well as a low increase in deer populations over the last 3 years with the mild winters we've had. We would recommend an increase in permits for the Plateau Thousand Lake, Fish Lake, and Plateau Boulder units by 30%. I would ask that the RAC would entertain a motion for this increase. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. Our predator advisor was on the cougar management plan, and I talked to him a little bit about how close we are to that plan, and he believes we're right on. So United Wildlife Cooperative supports the plan as presented.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
We did receive a letter from the Utah Houndsmen Association. Just says the Utah Houndsmen Association has reviewed the 2017 Cougar recommendations. The recommendations appear to follow the current Cougar management plan, and we support these recommendations. We also have a letter from SFW. SFW supports the Cougar recommendations and rule amendments for 2016-2017 as presented by the DWR, with one exception, that the Southwest Manti unit be increased from 5 cougar permits to 8. The rationale, the entire Manti unit is under objective for deer, which qualifies it for predator management. 8 on the Southwest unit would be a modest increase from the previous objective of 5 and would help the struggling deer population. Additionally, SFW would like to acknowledge the sound science, thoroughness, and professionalism with which the DWR has conducted its research prior to making the 2016-2017 Cougar recommendations.
Okay, thank you. Darren, let me just ask you real quick, make sure I get this right in my notes. There's the Plateau Thousand Lake unit and the Plateau Fish Lake. Was there any others?
As well as the Plateau Fish Lake, just the Fish
and
Lake.
And the Boulder. Didn't you mention the Plateau Boulder?
And the Plateau Boulder.
And the Plateau Boulder. So there's three?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's all the comment cards. Looks like we have one more coming up. Thank you.
John Keeler, Utah Farm Bureau. We too would like to support an increase in the Southwest Manti, the Plateau, and Boulder. We have received comments from producers of increased sightings and increased activity and incidents there, so we would favor an increase there.
Okay, thank you, John. Okay. That's it from the audience. We have comments from the RAC. Mike.
Let me see if I've got this right. In those three units that Darren mentioned, there's 26 permits sold in there, and so the 30% increase that he's asking would be about close to eight permits increase. Is my math right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, okay. One of those units is already recommended as an increase by the region as well. So is that on top of what the region's already recommending?
Darren, I guess I would go to you.
Yes, the numbers would stay the same as the Plateau Fish Lake is only increased by one.
Okay. Craig,
can I ask a question? What's the success rate on these units? So particularly these ones we're talking about. Well, and I'm also interested in Pine Valley and the Southwest Desert.
So one thing I do want to point out on the Plateau Thousand Lake is that one is right at 40% on its females. It is not under for predator management. So the region should be recommending a decrease there, and they did not. So an increase there would be going against the plan. On the Plateau Fish Lake, the region did recommend an increase of one. And on the Plateau Boulder, the region recommended to stay the same. On the Harvest, the Fish Lake, Total Harvest, it was 100% success. The Thousand Lake is 50% success.
It exceeded it on the Boulder.
And on the Boulder, we exceeded the harvest last year. It was over-harvested. Okay. And then the Pine Valley.
Wildlife Services.
Wildlife Services helped remove some animals there. So Pine Valley, the success was 10 out of 12. And Southwest Desert, 7 out of 9. So that's the other thing you have to look at, too, is some of these units, you can put more permits on there, and if you success. I mean, like Southwest Desert is one that's really hard. Any of our West Desert units, we have a hard time getting hunters into those to harvest.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments from the rack? Okay, I just want to summarize again, if we get this right. So the Mule Deer Foundation, which is supported by the Farm Bureau, would support an increase by 30% on the plateau units, those three, Boulder, Thousand Lakes, Fish Lake. And then also there was a recommendation by SFW to increase the Manti unit, which is also supported by the Farm Bureau, from 5 tags to 8. So I believe that's, and then the other letters and comments that we received have basically been in support of the plan as presented. I'm ready for a motion.
Chairman, I'd like to make a motion on the Cougar recommendations as recommended by the division, with the exception of a 30% increase on the Thousand Lake, the Fish Lake, and the Boulder, and the Southwest Manta.
Okay, so let me just ask you a quick question. On the Southwest Manti unit, the increase was from, the recommendation was from 5 to 8 and not a 30% increase. Do you want to, is your motion 30% for all those units?
Just to get it up to the 8 that they recommended.
Is that 30%?
From 5 to 8 on the Manti and then 30% on the.
Okay, do you want to restate your motion then for us?
Okay. So a 30% increase on the Thousand Lake, Fish Lake, and Boulder Plateaus, and 3 permits on the Southwest Manti.
Okay. There's an increase from 5 to 8.
Correct.
Do we have a second on that motion? We have a second from Wade. Okay. Is there any discussion on the motion? Brian?
Just clarification. You did include the Plateau Thousand Lakes that is at 40% female harvest.
Yes, that was included. Which, that's according just, to Leslie, goes against the plan.
That's what I was just going to go with. We put a lot of work into those plans, and I'm all about killing cats, but. Do we want to think about that before we send it off? I mean, just discuss it anyway so they know that it just wasn't a raised our hand and went to it. So,
okay. Wade?
And I kind of agree with Brian. We talked about this a lot last year. It doesn't make any sense to throw more permits at units where we're not reaching the quota anyway, which we're not on the Thousand Lakes. Rusty, what's your thoughts about amending that motion and excluding the Thousand Lakes and leaving the other three?
Okay. I'll amend the motion and exclude the Thousand Lakes.
Second.
Okay. Now, is there any discussion on the amendment? Okay. So we need to. Okay,
Leslie. Ask one question. So your motion was to increase, so that would leave the Plateau Boulder and the Plateau Fish Lake, so increase those two units by 30%. So on top of the one that we recommended.
On top of the recommendation.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, let's have a vote on the amendment. Okay. All those in favor? All those opposed? Okay. You got that count? Motion carries. So the amendment passes. Let's. Well, that's. I think we still need to. It changed the original motion, so now let's vote on the motion. I guess since we had an amendment, we still need to follow through and vote on the motion. Is there any further discussion on the motion?
Somebody restate the
motion. So we can restate it. Wade?
Okay, so the motion reads right now that we passed the division's proposal with three exceptions. First being the Plateau Boulder is increased by 30%. Second, the Plateau Fish Lake is increased by 30%. And third, Southwest Manti is increased by from 5 to 8.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor? All those opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. Okay, we have...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last action item is item number 9, the proposed fee schedule, and that'll be Kenny Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kenny Johnson, the Admin Services Chief from Salt Lake City. It's always nice to leave the chaos of Salt Lake and come down and visit Southern Utah. So happy to be here. Let's hope so. It's gotten a little better.
This feels like St. George.
Baking bread down here. Okay, so tonight we've got a couple of fee items to discuss. Nothing super major in here. Really looking at three categories, essentially. We've got an increase, a decrease, and then a possible new opportunity. So it's kind of those three categories, and we'll just hammer through them. I think we only have about four slides, so we'll try to make it quick. All right, good. I think most of us are familiar with the process of changing a fee. It's a little bit clunky, it's a little bit time-consuming, and that's why we're here now. So the process essentially is we present our proposed fee changes to the RACs and then to the board, and anything that gets approved out of the public process then goes to the governor's office for review and a recommendation to the legislature. And then the Natural Resources Subcommittee will then reject or approve or maybe modify those fees. And then anything they approve goes into the annual appropriations bill that's voted on by all the legislators. And then it becomes part of the law the next fiscal year. So anything we talk about tonight would essentially come into play about a year from now on July 1st of 2017. The impact, so again, some of the reasons we bring fees out through the process, usually to generate some revenue. It could be for recruitment, retention kind of tools that we have in the tool chest to get more people involved and interested in hunting and fishing, and then some housekeeping items. And so we've actually got a little bit of each of those tonight. And the hope is that when we do make an increase, it's kind of a zero-sum game. It's just enough to cover the costs of those programs. And so those are some of the fiscal impacts. So the first one we'll talk about tonight is a reduction. We're trying to encourage more youth to be out pursuing and hunting turkeys during the general season turkey hunt. And so we're proposing a reduction from currently the price of $35 down to $25. With that reduction, all things being equal, that would be a net reduction in revenue of about $20,000, give or take. And so the idea is if we can recruit more youth, maybe give dad and mom a break where they have, you know, multiple turkey hunter age kids, that we may appeal to a few more of them, get a few more out in the field. Since that's a, you know, roughly a 30% reduction, it would take about that many more youth to break even. But all things being equal, on the conservative side, we would potentially stand to lose about $20,000 in revenue if it doesn't have the impact we're looking for. But we look at that as a real positive and kind of a break to families. The next one, we just kind of missed this one last time we took fees through with big game related items. This is a multi-season deer hunt, so it gets a little wordy and verbose, but essentially on our limited entry and premium limited entry units, the three-season opportunity is is a lot higher value than just a single weapon, an archery, a muzzleloader rifle. And we missed adding the multi-season when we took these through last time a few years ago. And so really for this one, it's kind of more of a housekeeping thing to just be able to charge for that little bit higher value opportunity. And so if we go down through the bullet points, the resident premium multi-season, right now they're paying just the single season price of $168, and we're proposing that go to $305. The non-resident version of that one, they're paying $568 currently, and we're proposing that move to $1,025. And on the limited entry units, multi-season for residents would move from $80 under this proposal to $145, and the non-resident version of that from $468 to $845. So a little bit, we don't offer a ton of those, so it's just a little tiny bit of net increase in revenue, and it's more just to bring it in line with the elk and the other things that we're doing with multiple seasons. This next one, it's an idea that came out of one of the elk committees, and we think it's great. We haven't fleshed out any of the details. I think it's important to establish that tonight. This is just kind of establishing the fees, so if we do adopt something in the future, which would come back through this process, we'd have a fee in place to do this one. And so the idea is to be able to offer both a resident and a non-resident general season multi-season elk hunt. So establishing a fee there so they don't exist currently. The resident fee is proposed at $150, non-resident at $700. And again, just the idea of having a general multi-season elk opportunity available to the public. We're also proposing antlerless elk mitigation reduction that's currently $50 down to $30. And we estimate an increase in revenue when all that's said and done of about $90,000. Okay, the last one. This one we're just looking for ways on division-sponsored events. So it could be a shooting event, fishing event, some outdoor recreation program event. We're looking for kind of a flexible way to be able to charge a little bit of money to recoup some of those actual costs. So we don't really know what those will be across the board, but we want the flexibility to, you know, if a shooting event's going to be $7 or $8 for shells and targets and whatever else, we'd like to be able to charge some kind of participation fee just to recoup those actual costs for those outdoor rec programs. That second bullet point, this is a really limited opportunity right now. I think Lee K is the only place this is available. It's a fee for RV camping at our shooting centers. And right now it's just the Lee K Center in Salt Lake. And we want to put a kind of a broader range on that one as well, because we don't use it very much now. And I think this fee could probably live into the future 20 more years before we change it again. And so if we can establish a little bit of a flexible range in there, I think that'll cover our needs into the, you know, kind of well into the future. So in summary, we hope some of these will help us recruit and retain more youth, provide a little bit of a financial break to families, possibly offer down the road a new opportunity for the public, and provide a small amount of related revenue. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kenny. Do we have any questions from the rack? Mac?
Tell me how this antlerless elk mitigation tag works.
So those are opportunities that landowners provide hunting opportunity on places where people can't really access or don't have as much access, but we still need to have elk removed. And so right now they're paying the full $50, and it's kind of a similar concept to kind of the antlerless control permits that sell over the counter at more of that $30 price point. So that's how those work.
Okay, Craig.
I'm just curious on this, I guess, and this is just a proposal that on the resident elk multi-season, that's it, not something that's going on now. That's something that you just may come, we may go to sometime.
Correct. Yeah, it doesn't exist now. We want to just establish the fee. I think the idea had some pretty good excitement and support through the committee. So it's an idea that we're behind. We don't have any of the details fleshed out. Just want to get the fee on the books.
So if I bought a regular spike tag, I could pay a little bit more and get a multi-season spike tag then.
That's kind of the idea. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Any questions down this way? Do I have questions from the audience? Lee?
Lee Tracy, I have a couple of questions. This elk, multi-season elk permit sounds a little bit like a dedicated hunters. Are there going to be any changes to that? Is that a one-year deal or a three-year deal, or would there be any changes to that?
Lee, I was on the elk committee on the elk plan committee, and this was a topic that came up, and we talked about it extensively for like two or three meetings. Of just one of the biggest things we had on one of our objectives of that committee was to create more opportunity for the general public, because our elk numbers are up, and this was just an idea that was thrown out in the elk plan through that committee as a way to offer more opportunity to the public. It's not in place at this time, but it is in the plan to go to sometime, the way I understand it. I think Kenny, you correct me if I'm wrong, but.
No, I think that's right on, so.
All right. Now, you mentioned specifically recruiting youth to that to the turkey hunt. I'm assuming that reduction is for everybody, not just the youth. Is that right?
Right now we're proposing it as just for youth, for the general season hunters.
Okay.
Yep, so not across the board, just for youth.
All right, thanks.
Good questions. Thank you for the clarification. We don't have any comment cards on this. Do we have any comments from the RAC? Wade?
I think these are some great changes, especially like that youth general turkey permit reduction, and especially liked the picture in the multi-season deer slide.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other comments? Gene.
On this elk thing, I'm all for increasing opportunity. I'm a little concerned about how much this is going to stress elk. How many hunters are going to be out there pushing from what? The archery season starts in early September, and they'd be able to push through the muzzleloader season. It goes into November.
So the idea is they wouldn't hunt continuously from archery through the end of muzzleloader, just those actual seasons. So they'd be participating with everybody else, but not in between.
Right, but that's still, has the amount of stress that puts on the elk been considered in making this plan?
I appreciate that, Gene. It's one of those things that we'll have to put in a proposal that'll come back out here that'll flesh out the details. We haven't worked through them at this point. It's just tonight's just getting the fee ready, and then at some future point we'll have a little more details filled in about how that's going to work and potentially look. But I'm sure that'll be considered.
Okay. We want to see increased opportunity. We just don't want to see too much of it.
I didn't think I'd hear that from you, Gene. That's good. Okay, if there's no further comments, I'll entertain a motion. Nick?
I'd like to move that we approve the proposed fee schedule from Kenny Johnson, I guess.
Okay, as presented. Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Okay, motion carries unanimous. That's our last agenda item. Looks like our next meeting will be on September 13th at 7 p.m. at the Sevier School District Office. And that'll be the fishing recommendations and guidebook. Unless Gary has anything to add, we'll call this meeting adjourned.